So I have the privilege of introducing Terrence Smith, the moderator for this plenary. And first, I have the fun of sharing with you my big idea. And my big idea began in the teacher's lunchroom of a public high school in the Bronx, where I taught social studies for 5 years. And during my first year of teaching, my colleagues and I would often talk about books that we wanted our students to read. We would talk about field trips that would bring the subject matter to life, microscopes we needed for a science experiment, supplies needed for an art project. But these ideas never went beyond the teacher's lunchroom because we didn't have a funding source to realize those ideas. We would spend a lot of our own money on copy paper and pencils, and that was part of the $1 billion a year that teachers spend out of their own pockets on supplies. But apart from the few supplies that we could personally afford, we saw our students going without the materials and experiences needed for a great education. And while we were having this lunchroom conversation, I figured that there were people from all walks of life who wanted to help improve our public schools, but they just felt like a donation to the public school system might go into a black hole. But if there was a way for people to choose a specific classroom project to support and see their dollars at work, then we teachers would have a way to get our students those books and take them on that field trip and do that science experiment. So I created a rudimentary website where public school teachers could post classroom project requests, and any donor could choose the project that he or she would like to fulfill. And then my mom helped me make dessert for my colleagues, and I put the dessert in the teacher's lunchroom, and I said, whoever eats this dessert has to go to this newly created website and ask for whatever it is you most want for your students. It's called donorschoose.org. 11 of my colleagues ate the dessert and posted the first project requests. About a year later, Newsweek's Jonathan Alter, who's here at the Ideas Festival, took notice of this experimental website growing out of my classroom. He went out on a limb and he wrote that he thought donorschoose.org would one day change the face of philanthropy. So we've tried to prove him right. To date, 53,000 classroom projects have been funded at our website, providing books and art supplies, field trips, technology, and other resources to 1.2 million students from low-income families. So our big idea is to let every teacher be an innovator, to let every citizen be a philanthropist, and to create a world where students in every community have the resources that they need to learn. So now it's over to Terrence Smith, who is an award-winning journalist who's reported for CBS News, The New York Times, and is now a special correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I wonder if we can come up with an idea half as good as that one. I'd be satisfied. Anyway, welcome, everybody. Let me introduce a terrific panel on this subject of workforce preparedness and the American workforce and how it stands and what challenges it faces. Starting on my immediate right is the Secretary of Commerce, Carlos Gutierrez, Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings, Sidney Harmon, who is Chairman of Harmon Industries, Dr. Judith Roden, who is President of the Rockefeller Foundation, before that was President of the University of Pennsylvania, and Tom Wilson, who is the Chairman and CEO of the Allstate Corporation. This whole subject is probably one of the most important and least discussed. And it's getting, I notice, only passing mention in the presidential campaign. But let me just point out a few facts as a point of departure and then turn immediately to the panel. The American workforce, as we know it and as we know, is remarkable in terms of innovation, technology, productivity, work ethic, and more. That's the good news. But the American preeminence in that is obviously and clearly under challenge. It's under challenge from India, from China, from actually scores of countries where the workforces are growing in their education, their preparation, and most important, their zeal to compete. Education is obviously the key to this, especially K through 12. The U.S. is falling behind in this area and has real problems, and Margaret Spellings can talk about that. Lifelong education, a key component in all of this, is something I hope we'll talk about. What's missing, it seems to me, in the debate is a sense of urgency about it, almost as though, as Tony Lewis once wrote about Britain years ago, it was going giggling into the sea. Well, you know, I think we're dreamwalking here, and there is not the sense of urgency that you might imagine. These are just some of the observations that emerged from a remarkable pair of dinners that Tom Wilson and Allstate sponsored earlier this year in Washington and in Chicago. And in a moment, I'll ask Tom Wilson to sort of summarize what was said, what he learned, and what he took away from those dinners, particularly in terms of possible solutions. But let me start first with Secretary Guterres. You're the federal official who's in the crosshairs of this debate. Give us your view of the nature of the problem, the extent of the problem, and what the government can do about it.
Well, just to frame it, we have today, over the last 30 years, what we have seen is about 40%, a little over 40% of the world's population, countries representing over 40% of the world's population, basically adopting a liberal market policy. So essentially, they are competing with us. They had a totally different model years ago, and today we have over 40% of the world's population competing for capital, competing for jobs, competing for growth. So the question is, how do we prepare our people? And I say prepare in a really broad sense. How do we prepare our people to compete in that environment, which is going to get more and more and more competitive? And the second question is, how do we attract new people who will help us compete and who will bring a sense of vibrancy and energy and new ideas to our country? We usually refer to that as immigration, but just in a broad sense is, how do we attract new people? And I think those are the two big challenges. Obviously, government policy has a lot to do with that. But I think we all have a lot to do and a big role to play in each one of those.
Margaret Spellings, any discussion of this topic almost immediately goes to education. It goes to the way American workers are prepared or not prepared, and whether they have an opportunity that is feasible, economical, affordable, to retrain during the course of a career. We know that today you don't work for one company in one job for the rest of your life. It doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So what's the answer?
Well, we have to focus on this, the entire continuum. And, you know, one of the things that I'm most worried about is the pipeline, the lack of preparedness in our high schools. Today, half of our minority kids in this country get out of high school on time. You're from California. I'm from Texas. In Texas, we are a majority-minority public school system. And if half of the kids coming out of that system, or half the kids don't even, you know, they're not coming out of the system at all, at any level of preparation, we are in a world of hurt. Terry, you gave the statistics about India and China and other places. I would suggest that that's even worsened by the fact that our future is about innovation. It's about knowledge. It's, you know, we want to continue to be the idea place. And so the stakes are even higher, and the expectations are even higher, I think, for our system on institutions. Now, love or hate No Child Left Behind, it has done something really important, and that is put the elephant on the dining room table. We simply have to make this issue urgent and personal for the American people. They have to understand that even though, you know, I'm a suburban mom and my kid's going to a decent high school, that's fine and dandy, but what about the kid in Laredo, Texas, or Anacostia, or East LA, or whatever? Because that is our future, and we have not made the case well enough that we all have a very, very strong interest in that. Now, with respect to lifelong learning, you're right. You know, this is, we have to have kids who are coming out of high school who have the level of skill to be able to continue to think and learn throughout a lifetime. But I would suggest that, and God knows we try to catch people up, you know, later in life, that getting it right in the first place, having kids that can read and cipher on grade level, is a real good place to start.
Sydney Harmon, you know about this both as a manager and as an author, someone who's written about this, who's approached it, therefore, from the practical and the theoretical. I wonder if you think the pipeline that Margaret Spellings is talking about is being filled properly, is being trained with people. Are they coming along?
Oh, I think we have an instinct to discount our progress at virtually every level. It's astonishing how much America seems to accomplish despite our misgivings. I would like to focus on a narrow but crucial area here, Terrence. It is the workplace itself. I think of no area more conducive to generating learning among workers than the workplace. I cite quickly three incidents of my own experience. In 1975, at a crazy time in my life, when I was running a transnational Quaker college as its president, based on the teachings of Aristotle and Illich and Paulo Freire, the student is the center of the educated universe, the faculty is resource, the very reverse of the traditional top-down. Mm-hmm. I was also running my business in the tradition of top-down. We had a revolution at a plant in Bolivar, Tennessee, the most retrogressive area in the country. The incidence of alcoholism, drug addiction, suicide in that plant was the highest in the nation. And when this revolt occurred, I was told to get out of my suit and get down there. I had something of an epiphany. Apply the principles of the college to the workplace. And we did that. And it's the first time it is said in numbers of the business schools that a serious effort was engaged by the country to alter the traditional adversary relationship between workers and managers. We had school on the premises that taught not just upskilling, but things people, employees, knew how to teach, piano, writing, that sort of thing. In essence, what it did was to generate a connection between the employee and the company that gave the employee an emotional commitment to the company. When that happens, anytime, anywhere it happens, the opportunities for innovation, productivity are increased dramatically. We have at Harmon over the years applied those principles with the endless support of Ann Korologos, who's the lead director of the company, the former Secretary of Labor, who sponsored that thinking and encouraged it. And I give you one last incident and stop for a moment. A few years ago, in our plant in Northridge, California, a wonderful woman who had worked on a production line there for 24 years was savagely murdered by her former husband as she left the factory. Now, any company in the country would have responded to that with expressions of profound regret to the family, the funding of scholarships for the surviving children in the family. We determined that we'd better darn well find out something about this domestic violence stuff. We were astonished to learn that almost one out of every three women in the country had at some time in her lifetime been the subject, the object of domestic violence. We set up a program throughout the company that prompted people to come forward to say, for the first time in my life, I feel comfortable. I feel assured. I feel that I am in a place that cares for me. What kind of an environment does that produce? What kind of work of preparation does that represent?
Dr. Judith Roden, you approach this both as an educator and now in the with the Rockefeller Foundation. What's the role of the nonprofit world in this? What have they got to offer?
Well, it's wonderful. In the not-for-profit sector, the foundations have the opportunity to innovate, to look for experiments, to try to push the envelope with new ideas. We're not focused on the next election or the next quarterly earnings, and so we really can try some new ideas. Here we're talking about a very diversified workforce. This is not your grandparents' workforce anymore. Almost a third of workers are either contractors or freelancers. They don't have traditional employer relationships, and so they're not getting their health care, their pension. They're retraining through employers, and we've been working with a variety of NGOs, some for-profit companies, Towers Perrin and others, to really think about how to deal with the needs of that workforce as they will change jobs a number of times, as you said, but also as many of them are no longer in the traditional employee-employer relationship. And that is one of the consequences both of globalization and the way people are being trained. A second issue that we've been focusing on, because it's shocking data, Harry Holzer, who's a labor economist at the Urban Institute, looked at federal data in which he said the issue has to be training and not jobs. And so the middle skill jobs in America are increasing and will actually continue to increase, at least through the projection that they looked at, which was 2014. These are jobs in healthcare, construction, transportation, maintenance, repair, and we're not training the workforce for these kinds of jobs that can't go offshore but need the right kind of training in order to accommodate the needs of our competitive opportunities as Americans. And yet, since 1979, and I shudder to give data because my friend Ann Korologos keeps correcting my labor statistics data, but Ann, I'm going to try one more time.
Ann, come up here.
Since 1979, at least our data suggest that the real expenditures of the Department of Labor in workforce development efforts have actually dropped more than 70%. They've gone from $6.1 billion to $5 billion. And if you look at, obviously, inflation-adjusted dollars, this is really quite extraordinary. So what do we need? We need job training. We need a different kind of social safety net for this new, more diversified workforce, different kinds of products that aren't employer-based. That's going to take very different federal policies, since so much of our thinking, even now, about how to change healthcare is coming through that traditional employer-based system, and that's not going to serve. And then finally, as a university president, we need to keep supporting the research universities, which have been the engine of innovation, both the publics and the privates. Since post-Second World War and the great Vannevar Bush report, the United States decided to invest its innovation engine into the great public and private universities, and they are actually suffering. And so we need the kind of effort in higher ed that Secretary Spellings talked about in K-12, new ideas, new engines of innovation, new investments. I was most recently with an official of the Chinese government, and I'll leave you with just this last number. He told me that in the next 5 years, they plan to build 197 science and technology transfer parks around universities that they're developing across China. They very much admire what we've done in America. Silicon Valley is their role model. 197 science and technology parks. We need to wake up, America. It's going to pass us by.
I'll give you another statistic to go with that. Mike Milken of the Milken Institute says that by 2020, 80% of the graduate-level engineers in the world will be working and living in Asia, even though many of them will have been trained in the United States. So that raises the question, obviously, of whether we are shipping some of this talent overseas. Tom Wilson, give me your observations. You've come at this subject at a couple of very interesting dinners that you convene with people, including a former Secretary of Commerce, Bill Daley, in Chicago, and many people in Washington, including Bill Brody, the outgoing president or head of Johns Hopkins University. So you've looked at this. What have you taken away from those dinners and from these observations?
Well, there are, I think, four conclusions we came to, and then we have some ideas and things that could be done differently. First conclusion would be investing in people has been a good thing for America and a good thing for the world. And we're nowhere close to the point of diminishing marginal returns. Therefore, we should invest more in people. Seems obvious, but it oftentimes gets lost in the conversation. Secondly, globalization has been good for America and good for the world. The problem is in America, those benefits have not been distributed broadly across our society. I think third, because of that globalization, it's pretty clear that our workers are less competitive today than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or 20 years ago. And then lastly, I would agree with Secretary Spellings that improving education is a core part of it, but I think we would say it's not the only part of it, that there's much more that needs to be done than just improving education. So in true Aspen Institute style and with some coaching from my new friend Sydney, we actually put this down on paper, which you can get on the way out. We said we had four ideas we came up with as a result of some help from these dinners, and the Atlantic was very helpful with this as well. The first is we need to create an American culture of lifelong learning, which means, you know, we got to do marketing around it. We got to change the period of time people are in school, go from 18 maybe to 20. We need to get businesses to be, as Sydney talked about, be more involved in helping educate people along the way. So we need to just raise it so that education is not viewed as a once and done, but education is forever. So I know we might have to pay De Beers or somebody a license on that, but if we could make education just part of our culture. Secondly would be that we have a couple ideas at the federal government level, which is to create a council, President's Council on Worker Competitiveness, which would have the same kind of status as a National Security Council or National Council of Economic Advisors, where it could bring together the secretaries of labor and commerce and education to help build something that is focused really on worker competitiveness, on that topic, because as we learned, it's sort of everywhere. You know, it's in what private business does, it's in what the rules are, it's what regulations are, it's what the Education Institute does. So provide really a vehicle for the president to really drive leadership around this. Third would be to have the federal government step up and fund more money. If you look at the whole the deficit in our public school education system, it's huge. So our suggestion was $250 billion over 5 years, given to local school districts, community colleges, and nonprofits to really build a world-class infrastructure, both hard and soft. We don't have that today. We know we don't have it today. There's nobody else willing to step up that has the money to do it. And then secondly, at the federal government level, to work on the worker piece, which is to take, there's something called the Trade Adjustment Act, which if your job gets lost to overseas, there's about $1 billion the government has available so that you can help in that transition. The reality is that money is hard to get, not broadly used, and not enough. And so the suggestion we had from a group of financial services companies was combine it with unemployment insurance, expand it, make it available to more people, put progressive taxes in for people to pay for that. So that would be there. And then the last is to just make learning easy. Everybody's busy. People have kids. They have jobs. So if we could take our public school infrastructure, it's not used that much after 4 o'clock, perhaps a community college, nonprofits could be able to use that. Maybe we could provide care for people so they don't have to drive 15 miles, but they can walk to their neighborhood school and get educated. Try to make it fun. Use some of our entertainment and multimedia expertise. Why does everything have to be 1 hour with the textbook and, you know, a notebook in front of you? That's not the way we all ingest information. And last was under that was to make it easy was to create a tax credit. It seems odd to us that large businesses, we don't do a lot of research and development, but large businesses get a research and development tax credit. So if they do research, they get a tax credit on it. Individuals, There are a little bit of education tax credits, but they're needs-based. You got to be in a certain program. It's got to lead to a degree. There are nowhere near those kinds of restrictions on companies in terms of investing in research which helps drive our economy. It seems like we should have broader research and development tax credits for individuals in terms of learning. So I thought it was a good set of meetings, and people are very engaged in it.
Well, I mean, these are interesting ideas, and let me ask the two cabinet secretaries what they think of those, and because most of the burden of those ideas would fall, as Tom described it, on the federal government. Margaret Spellman.
Well, let me first start with the resource piece, and we do need to spend more money. We've been spending more money. I can't take issue with Judith's statistic, but I can tell you that at the Department of Education, the Pell Grant has been a giant engine of funding, if you will, for job training in community colleges. We had the largest increase in 30 years last year. Likewise, in that period since 1979, we've reformed our welfare system, and much of those job training monies now flows through HHS, through TANF, and other such programs. So I think you have to look more broadly at sort of the resource issue. But let's stipulate that we are going to spend more money. And one of the things that I think we really have to do, and Tom got into this a little bit, is start to look at these institutional impediments and barriers. I mean, the assumptions that we make before we start tackling public policy problems is, okay, we're going to have a system that is, tenured faculty, 180-ish days a year, in both higher education and in K-12. We're going to have full-time and only full-time people. We're going to go 6 hours a day. We're going to be off during the summer. The words 24/7 have almost no relevance in education and in job training in America as it is constructed by the system. And so, you know, No Child Left Behind equals more vigorous data and exposing what the issues are, where we have problems, very specifically, what school, for what population, in what subjects, et cetera. That, God willing, begets an appetite in the public to frame out a demand for more systemic, more institutional change. We cannot tackle this without figuring out how we're going to use people and time in better ways, and those are the sacred cows of these two systems.
Secretary Guterres, Tom Wilson used a figure, $250 billion over 5 years. Mm-hmm. Now, I could be cruel and point out that that's about 1 year's worth of the war in Iraq, but that would be a cheap shot, so I wouldn't want I wouldn't want to do that. What's your reaction to that and to his idea of creating a president's council on this issue?
Well, I'll let Margaret deal with the money because she's got the budget. So she's. But look, I mean, I. Before we say let's put money into it, I think you have to step back and ask what are you going to put money into, and there is an inclination to boil this down to a very simple solution. And as always, the simple solution often is not the right one. But we want something quickly, so we've all boiled it down to math and science. So that's it. Just math and science. Get everybody you can. And I think we should step back and look at our country, look at our society, and ask why are we the world's leader, and what are the skills that got us there? What I see is, we're great at math and science. We invent technologies. We invent new ideas. But we're also number one in book publishing. We're also number one in music. We're also number one in cinema. That's innovation. And I don't know if in our schools we are looking for students with that broad of talent, if we are looking to find that maybe not everyone is good at math and science, but they may just be misplaced if we're looking for them to have a math and science degree. So that's one area. The other area I'd throw out that we absolutely need to make a priority, and I know that Margaret has made a priority throughout her department, throughout schools, is languages. We are fortunate that the whole world feels the obligation to speak English. So that is a tremendous luxury that we have. But, the Chinese can read our plans, and they do. We can't read their plans. And it's going to come a point in time where they're going to realize that if they start telling us that we need to speak their language, if we want to do business in their country, we're going to be in deep trouble.
That's an interesting point. You know, let me interrupt that. My wife and I were in China last year, and billboards there promoting this very idea of learning English say, success in English, success in life. They say this in English and Chinese. And the Milken Institute has another statistic that by 2025, more Chinese will speak English than the combined populations of all the English-speaking countries. Now, that's obviously a reflection of the size of China. I understand. But, Sidney Harmon, what about this innovation edge that Secretary Guterres is talking about, which is certainly true and has been true over the last 30, 40 years? Are we losing it?
Well, we certainly compromise it when we bring foreign students into the country, educate them superbly, and then, in effect, kick them out. The president of the University of Maryland suggested just yesterday that on graduation, a green card ought to be stapled to the certificate. It's a kind of short-sightedness that we should be truly ashamed of. I believe it fair to suggest here, especially at Aspen, that it's appropriate to reconsider America's role in the world altogether when you speak of innovation. And Secretary Guterres has suggested this, too. Now, we should abandon a notion of American exceptionalism, American triumphalism. We should work actively and vigorously with other countries and with the students of those other countries. I was stricken by Judith's comment about the transient character, the growing transient character of the workforce. That's not because our people have decided that they are now nomads. It's largely driven by the growing lack of interest on the part of those people by most of the people who run our large corporations. The view of the people as replaceable parts in that machine is the most destructive thing imaginable. The willingness, look, tomorrow, the Department of Labor will announce the loss of some, 60,000 jobs in June. Mm-hmm. Six successive months. We've got some critical stuff here, there is no doubt. The almost instant response of American industry to crises of that sort is to cut the workforce, to find ways to reduce cost. How infrequently do those managers check on how much it will cost to retrain the workers when the inevitable cycle occurs and we have to bring them back? How much consideration is given to developing an environment in that factory which causes those people to say, I want to stay here. They encourage me to stay here. It seems to me that as we lose sight of the fundamental, central importance of the workplace, we're at great danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
And of the worker and his dignity.
And, of course, of the
Here's the article you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the headline in today's New York Times lead story? Deepening cycle of job loss seen lasting into 2009. So this is seen as something that is growing and going forward, not diminishing. Judith?
Let me stipulate Sidney's point, with which I don't disagree, and say that what startled us in the research that we sponsored was how many workers are electing to be independent workers. That is, they didn't even make a first choice and get fired. They are really seeing a very different path for their own way of earning money, expressing themselves. The traditional employer in a large corporation, even in smaller companies, is no longer seen, and indeed the contract is gone. The employer doesn't see himself or herself as responsible for the worker, and so the worker is looking in a different way to himself or herself. So as we provide training opportunities, we really need to make sure that we're expanding those opportunities and not merely creating the worker who's going into the traditional jobs. The workplace itself, I think, will have to shift. As we talk about the American economy, there is no doubt that many of our workplaces are really framed around 20th century ideas about what a workplace should be like. Another New York Times article recently dealt with dads who had breakfast together after they dropped their kids off at school. And it was a wonderful article, and one of the things they said was how many of their high-powered wives were initially pretty jealous that they were able to drop the kid off at school. And these weren't stay-at-home dads who didn't have work. They were playwrights and artists and those who had more flexible work schedules. We have federal policies about flexibility, but most employers treat those policies as mandates that they struggle against, that they really hate to impose, and many of our workers hate to ask for rights that they already have. So we're talking about a total transformation mm-hmm. of how we define work, what working life should feel like, who the worker of the 21st century is, and how diverse this new population is going to be. And there is no single federal policy and no single federal program that can adapt to that. So we've got to shift to a new contract that really recalibrates who's bearing the training risk, who's bearing the individual risk. All that employer is doing right now is risk shifting yes. to the individual without any of the normative kinds of opportunities that we saw 50 years ago or even 25 years ago.
And I'm arguing that that's utterly short-sighted.
Right.
Tom Wilson, if indeed this social contract has between employer and employee really has changed in a fundamental way, first of all, do you agree with that? And we're talking across the board here in American working society. And what's the impact of it?
I think the social compact has changed. I think it is different. But I think most people want it. It's like transference. They want it to be somebody else started it, and it's other problem. It's really consumer driven. Clothes, shoes, all used to be made up in the Northeast. Now they're made all offshore. It's not because a bunch of people up in the Northeast decided it would be easier to go move everything to the Philippines and they had nothing better to do. It's because people said, I want to buy that shirt for cheaper. I want to buy two shirts, not one shirt. I want to buy a shirt and save some money. And so our economy sort of always forces that, and it has forced a change. You're starting to see a swing back. We're doing a lot more investing in things like health, wellness, energy, work, family, life. So you're seeing some businesses start to swing back and say it moved too far. But there is that ongoing pressure around how do you deliver the best product at the lowest possible price, which is what consumers demand. And if you doubt that, ask yourself where your clothes came from. Probably not many of them came from in the United States. So. But, you know, the thing I think we sometimes lose sight of, both as a business and as a country, and I want to go back to the concept of, are we losing our innovation edge? You know, we are the leader. This is America. We're used to winning. We will continue to win. But I don't really think the question is whether China is going to catch us or India is going to catch us. It's how much have we left on the table already. Mm-hmm. So it's versus what's possible. So today, you know, there's 5 million people who would like to work full-time and don't. Or something like 1.7 million people between the ages of like 16 and 24 who would like to work or don't have jobs. 5,000 kids drop out of high school every day. So if you're here for 5 days, 35,000 people. So the question, I think, becomes, you know, how many wonder drugs have we not discovered? How many manufacturing efficiencies have not been there? You know, how many poems have not been written? Because we've left all these people go. And I don't think people are really focused on sort of the upside potential. I think businesses, you know, we get caught in this quarterly, you know, I got to make my number this quarter. But that's about leadership and having guts as opposed to just, you know, caving to the pressure. So I think we have to shift the debate a little bit from let's just stay a little bit ahead of everybody else to what's possible. But I do think we're not going to be able to do this the way America has typically done it. You mentioned it earlier, Terry. There doesn't seem to be this sense of urgency. And my own view of American history is when we have a problem, we call the cavalry in, we throw all the money at it, we got tons of resources, really smart people, and we fix the problem. This, I think Secretary Spelling said this pipeline, this is like a 20 or 30 year pipeline. You know, you don't start filling this thing today and have better business results tomorrow. And there's a good line out of American literature, and somebody asked the guy, how did you go bankrupt? And he says, gradually, then suddenly. And I'm afraid that's kind of what's happened. You know, every day it seems okay. You know, the worker comp acts a little not great. It's getting a little better. And so how do we get people mobilized to actually do something about this and really make it is a people problem? I totally agree it's a people problem.
So the question may be addressed to us as a nation. How did we become second or third or worse? Gradually and then suddenly. Not one of you has mentioned, when we've been talking about who or what sector of the economy should deal with this, should it be government, should it be private industry, should it be education, nonprofit, not one of you has mentioned the unions, the labor movement, the ostensible organized force of the workers.
It's clear, well, because it's clear enough that the labor movement in this country has become relatively inconsequential. Tom spoke of trade adjustment assistance. Labor's view of trade adjustment assistance is that it is burial assistance. Labor was at one time in this country a profoundly progressive force, and clearly so in the workplace. It has made the same errors, the same bureaucratic errors, dealing with the workforce that I charge us snappy industrialists with having made. They have treated their members as replaceable parts in the machine. That's disaster.
The lady on your left begs to differ.
I do. In the public sector, that may be true in the private sector, but in the public sector, unions are alive and well and vigorous. And what I meant a minute ago in my veiled language of let's tackle the sacred cows of using time and people, that's what we're talking about. Work conditions, pay, rationing of equity, all of those sorts of things are all wrapped up in issues related to personnel, teachers' unions, systems, sacred cows, summer vacation, all of those sorts of givens that we are afraid to tackle, but that, in my view, we must if we're going to leap forward. We in Texas, we say, if all you ever do is all you ever done, then all you ever get is all you ever got.
Sounds.
You know what
Dan
I mean?
Dan Rather could have said that.
Absolutely. You know,
Secretary Guterres, but Sidney Harmon is right in his historical description of the role of the labor movement and its progressiveness, whatever you're talking about, 30, 40 years ago versus now, is he not?
Well,
I mean, in the larger context, the historical context?
If you look at, there are some communities in the country that have really excelled in the face of globalization, communities that once relied almost exclusively on textiles, and 25 years later, they have turned around their communities, and they're now high-tech communities, and they've now brought in foreign capital and foreign investment. How have they done it? Through a partnership of the private sector, academia, and government. And I would say that there's probably a fourth element missing there, which is labor unions. And why they are not part of that partnership, I think, is a question that deserves to be asked.
Judith Rodden?
Well, I think there are new forms of unions developing. One of our new grantees is called the Freelancers Union. They're trying to aggregate all of the freelance and contract workers and try to develop health insurance, savings, pension, for a population that doesn't do it through an employer. They're doing a phenomenal job. Very interesting, very edgy, very pro-labor, very pro-commerce, not regressive. We have the SEIU, who many think are looking for new kinds of experiments for how to be a labor union for the 21st century. So I think the traditional labor union is losing ground. Municipal unions, teachers' unions, may be the last vestige because it's easier to hold on. But in the other sectors, a different kind of union that sees themselves as strategic partners rather than as the enemy of the employer is really developing.
We're going to get another comment here, but I want to get some comments and questions from the audience. We have microphones on either side, please, and I believe there's a portable one somewhere, so please use them. But Secretary Guterres and Sidney both want to say something. Make
Yes, I wanted to add, if I might, another dimension to your taxonomy, and that is technology, where you see this revival taking place wherever you see it, or almost wherever you see it. You see an effort to make use of the new developing technology. That's both exciting and extraordinarily encouraging. I just quickly make the point that in the electronics industry, a handful of years ago, it was typical that 20% of total cost was represented by direct labor. Today, for all the technological advances that have been made, it is typically below 5%.
Right.
I ask you, in terms of where jobs should be, does it make much difference once it gets down to 1% whether the job is held in Indiana or Indonesia? It's something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Secretary Guterres, and then we do have questions here.
Just the point on unemployment, and we've talked about jobs. Our unemployment rate in May has increased, as you know, is 5.5%. And I want to make another point about it, but just to put that in perspective, it's below the average of each of the last three decades. So somehow we've been able to keep our unemployment rate below what it has been for the past 30 years. That unemployment rate, if you look at among people with a university degree and above, is below 3%. In fact, it's in the low twos. People without a high school diploma, it's above 8. So more than ever before, whether you have a job and whether it's a good job relates very directly to what your education
right.
has been.
But one of the interesting things, Tom Wilson, that has come up in these dinners has been that there, and this is almost a cultural question, that the desire to learn and the value assigned to education, many studies show, is less today than it was some time ago. So that's another concern. Let's take a question starting on the side. Go ahead, try it.
Try it? Okay. Thank you. Just a quick comment, Secretary Spelling. Einstein once said, the definition of insanity is if you try the same experiment over and over again and expect you're going to get different results. So that's kind of like the thing
Einstein
that you said.
Correlate to the text.
Yeah. I come from an upper Midwest city, and we have two classes. We have people who have intact families, live in suburbia, doesn't matter what flavor or color they are, go to high school, many of them go on to college, blah, 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 and so forth. Then we have the dysfunctional families in the central city, no books in the house, maybe one parent, and the graduation rates from high school, especially among the males, are deplorable. And it seems to me that unless we catch these kids in Head Start and preschool and get them by the time they're in kindergarten or first grade, you can do No Child Left Behind till you're blue in the face. Those kids aren't even going to make it to high school. And I think we have to put our resources into this thing and help these kids get started and get a 1,000-word vocabulary by the time they come into kindergarten.
Okay, a couple of things I need to react to that. One is, and I know you don't mean it this way, we have to get out of this blame the family thing. I mean, like everybody, I send the best kid I have up to the school every day, and I know all those moms and dads do as well. But, you know, yes, we need to do preschool, we need to do pre-K, but also those kids go to elementary schools and high schools that have the least qualified teachers in our system, that have, I mean, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area and you're going to Langley High School in suburban Fairfax County, you're going to have 27 opportunities to take an advanced placement class. And if you're at Ballou High School in inner city D.C., maybe three or four. These kids can't learn what they haven't been taught. They don't have qualified teachers. We are rationing our resources into the most away from the most challenging educational settings. And guess what? It doesn't work. And so, you know, yeah, we need to do pre-K, make sure that we get kids, you know, school ready, but that's not all.
Well, the question is suggesting more emphasis, more money.
You know, yeah, I mean, the states have, we have spent a ton of money in TANF. I would say that it's not more money, it's more quality. I mean, maybe it is more money, it probably is more money, but we have to start using that time in smarter, better ways around vocabulary, around early reading readiness, and those sorts of things. And frankly, there's a lot of resistance in that sector to some of those notions.
Take a question over here.
Thank you. Secretary Spelling, you and I got a chance to talk a little bit about this question during a speech you gave to some Teach for America alumni in Houston. And talking about global workforce development, I've heard a lot about what we need to do domestically in terms of math, science education, investing in schools, but what about the necessity to make sure that just like other students are coming to the United States, that we are sending our students abroad as well? Just about a little over 2% of America's 16 million college students study abroad each year. And it's a wonder that we don't yet completely know how to compete in the global marketplace. So what value should we be placing on international education?
A ton. And Condi Rice and I have led delegations of university presidents. In fact, Bill Brody went with us on the one to Asia. And we need to be very bullish about more two-way exchanges. And I know, I mean, I agree with Sydney on this, you know, whole globalization. That means we need to understand, learn their language, go there to study them as we would have them and welcome them to come and stay here. So, you know, much, much more emphasis on that. And not just in elite institutions, across the sector, community college students, public institutions, as well as the privates that, you know, obviously do tend to emphasize that sort of experience more.
The challenge is that it emphasizes the differentiation even further. The students who don't need a job in the summer are the ones who most typically are able to have those experiences. So
that's what
I endorse highly the need for this. It is absolutely essential. We're starting to see elites put in programs because they can afford it. We need to provide the resources that Sabine students in a variety of ways to be able to take advantage of and contribute to this global experience.
I think it's a very positive thing, but I would also say if you're going to Lawndale in the inner city in Chicago and you go to Kenilworth, that's like a different community too. And so maybe we could do a little more. Maybe we could do a little more getting people to go into other communities, learn how other students in other communities. So actually, as a society, we could come together better. So I'm all in favor of sending people offshore, but I also think we ought to spend more time getting to know people in the different cultural communities we have in America, so we have a stronger bond to grow here.
Secretary Guterres, and then another question here.
Just want to put in a plug for the private sector, because we tend to overlook sometimes just what an amazing impact businesses have on our society and on development. But U.S. companies essentially carried out the idea of the expat, the family that goes overseas. They live in five different countries. They spend 10 years overseas. That family comes back to the U.S. with a different view of the world. And those kids grow up with a different view of the world. And that's something that we shouldn't minimize, because that's another contribution of international companies that send U.S. citizens overseas, and they in turn become world citizens, and that has a spillover effect into our society, and that's just another addition to what you're saying.
Another question here, please. We're running out of time, but I'd love to get a couple more in.
Great. So currently, less than 0.1% of our expenditures on K-12 are invested in R&D. So even the potato chip industry manages to do 2 to 3% of sales. So what do you think we can do to invest more in R&D that will lead to an increase in learning technologies and an increase in our cumulative understanding about what educational interventions actually work? How could we make education research as respected and rigorous as NIH is in the biomedical area?
Well, first we have to start with valid, reliable, meaningful data. And you know, as I said, Love or Hate, No Child Left Behind, it has done that. There is standardization, and it can be used for research purposes. We can look at schools with that excel and sort through variables and figure out what is it they're doing, and likewise the converse on schools that are lagging. Of course, we could spend more money in research and development. As a social science, it has lacked that kind of focus that we've seen in other disciplines. But frankly, I think it's not in a small part because we've not had meaningful, vigorous, reliable, valid, comparable information about our schools, which we now do.
We can take one more question.
What do y'all think about paying high school students for good grades?
Paying high school students for good grades?
I know I would have done a lot better.
I wouldn't have paid any money. Sydney, you want to fund that?
No, I do not want to fund it. I think that's a deplorable idea. That's a cop-out. If we can't set the environment, which encourages you guys to think that learning is the essence of human life, mm-hmm. there's something darn wrong with us. We shouldn't be paying you to love learning.
There's also great psychological data that you sap intrinsic motivation by giving external incentives for things that people ought to be falling in love with. And there's lots and lots and lots of data about that. So I, too, think it's a terrible idea.
I
think you're great.
All right. I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank the panel for me, please.